This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Sharad Kutan and Ibrahim Sani. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Happy Friday. Hooray for the long weekend.
Yes, yeah. A long weekend. We haven't had a long weekend in some time, I think. Was it January or February? We had a spate of long weekends. Mm-hmm, it was like, you know, one long weekend after another. And
I think it was in February with the Chinese New Year and Valentine's Day and all. Yeah, that. I mean, I don't know, Valentine's Day wasn't a holiday, but yeah, but it was just...
It felt like a holiday, didn't it?
Well, I love long weekends, even more so than public holidays in the middle of the week. I don't know, something about having that extra day feels really decadent to me. So hooray for Labor Day on Monday. Labor Day is technically on Sunday, right? So Monday is a public holiday. There we go. As we head into the long weekend, we're going to go out with a bang because we've got a great show lined up for you this morning. Niels Ove Gustafsson, the Deputy CEO of BHIC Bofors Asia, will be on The Breakfast Grill today to discuss military spending. You'll be speaking to him, Ibrahim?
Yeah, so I'll be speaking to Niels Ove Gustafsson, and it's a very interesting company because it is a company that is over 120 years old. It is closely tied to Alfred Nobel. Nobel, he is famous because of the peace prizes and the economic prizes and so on. But he was essentially an inventor. And the biggest invention that he created was the dynamite. And Bofors was the company that the dynamite was sold out of. And from then on until today, Bofors has always been one of those companies that are closely related to cannons and defense spending and
so on. Are they big in Malaysia?
They are big in Malaysia because of the partnership that they have with Boasted Heavy Industries. So now they're creating this company called BHIC, Bofors Asia Sendirian Berhad. And they've been selling cannons to our Malaysian Navy since the 70s. So if you can imagine a Navy ship, mm-hmm. and you have these big cannons in front and at the back of the ship, mm-hmm. those guns are supplied by Bofors.
There you go. Okay.
Well, there was a scandal, remember? I think it was the late 90s. Related to the possibility of bribes being given in India. I think Rajiv Gandhi was kind of drawn into that vortex. I believe there was no evidence against him finally, but it's a very interesting thing because there was, for a time, Bofors was linked to this scandal.
Well, you know, I mean, generally with the opacity of defense spending that has, you know, given a rise to many people taking opportunities in different countries. No defense industry, I think, is completely free of leakages. And I think that's really quite interesting to see what this defense company has to say about being an arms supplier, about the creeping tension in the region, about new security threats.
Yeah, just correct myself, it was not the 90s, it was actually the 80s. Uh-huh. So it was accused of paying bribes in 1986.
Okay.
And related to the sale of howitzers to India, some 400 of them.
Okay, and as we are smack right in the middle of tax season right now, actually coming towards the end, and following the Panama Papers leak, there's been a lot of emphasis on the issue of tax avoidance. So today on Current Affairs at 8:35 a.m., we're going to be taking a closer look at this issue, tax avoidance versus tax evasion, and we've got lots of people weighing in, including the Datuk Paul Lau, who recently said that tax avoidance is perfectly legal, right? It's just the signal that you send, and we've discussed this quite extensively on The Morning Run. Also today is the property show at 9:35 a.m. The final Friday of the month means Chris Tan from Chur Associates joins us on the show. One of the queries today is about the Strata Management Act. So if you're interested in that, make sure you stay tuned. You could also send in your questions to us if you have any questions you'd like Chris Tan of Chur Associates to address on the Property Legal Clinic.
You know, Strata Management Act is closely tied to the Strata Management Tribunal as well. And I think the application of the tribunal follows very closely to what the Act allows. And I think this is extremely critical for individuals to actually listen in, because, you know, we as the country progresses more, there's this urban landscape that we have to deal with. Many of us actually have condos and apartments. And Strata Management Act allows for owners of such properties to actually have more say and more rights accorded to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, we discussed this Desa Kuladari, right? Where the entire building wants to be sold off to another party. But just
en masse, right?
En masse. But one or two individuals, if they don't want to sell it and they put out the sale, the entire building can't be sold. And I don't know whether that's a good thing.
And it's also full of legalese. I mean, you know, this is a really difficult topic for the everyday person to understand. I am also struggling to understand this topic, and I'm quite glad that Kristan will be joining us to discuss this further. That's on The Property Show, 9:35 a.m. today. But it's 6 minutes past 6 o'clock this morning. Let's do a quick catch up on the news. Yesterday, the Enforcement Agency Integrity Commission, the EAIC, held a press conference to say that they found that the police officers in charge of interrogating N. Dharmendran, who had died in police custody back in 2013, were responsible for his death. So the EAIC found that the D9 police officers, the Serious Crimes Division, the police officers that had beat up Dharmendran while he was in detention and later fabricated evidence to cover up the violent interrogation.
Yeah, in fact, the brutality extended to stapling his ears. One can only imagine what it might have been like to be in Dharmendran's seat during those the kind of closing hour of his death. It must have been extraordinarily terrifying.
There's a pathology report coming from HKL's forensic department, and it was quite, you know, traumatizing. They have acute massive loss of blood, hypovolemic shock,
which means
I have no idea.
Oh, okay.
That's serious.
That's from the pathology report. Right?
Yeah, we should look it up.
And there's over 52 bruises sustained on his body. And you know, you wonder what brought the cops to these.
This is interesting, right? So the I think the IGP has reserved comment on it.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a question of what's going to happen next. Are the police officers that have been named in this report going to be charged? And what are they going to be charged for? Are they going to be charged for homicide? Or are they going to be charged for first degree murder?
Well, the EAIC is recommending that action be taken or charges be filed against the police officers. Just to recap, the EAIC is the body that oversees police and other enforcement agencies. They came to being after Dharmendran's death, and I think Dharmendran's death was one of three deaths that happened in a month back in 2013, and that gave the need for police oversight and what happens for deaths in custody.
And the question, because has there been? Now, just coming back to that hypovolemic shock, it's actually the result of losing more than 20% of your body's blood or fluid supply. And that severe loss of fluid makes it impossible for the heart to pump sufficient amounts of blood to your body. That's exactly what's happened. So this guy...
The loss of blood.
It's a massive loss of blood that basically... disturbs or, you know, impedes the functioning of your heart. So,
well, what's also very disturbing is that they were found to, the police officers in question here have been found to be responsible for falsifying and tampering with evidence to try and cover up the fact that the interrogation was so violent.
So, you know, there are several things that I think critics have often looked at when it comes to when it comes to the question of brutality, custodial deaths, is, you know, how much of it is a question of culture, that basically that there is an organizational culture that promotes violence, and the thing that comes along with it, which is the cover up, right?
Yeah, the Band of Brothers Silence.
That's right. The band, you call it the Band of Brothers, and it's the idea that cops are going to stand up for cops more. They're going to stand up for the law and what is right. So if something goes wrong within their own ranks, they feel the need to protect their own. And that's really tragic.
So I'm trying to find the difference between the EAIC, the Enforcement Agents Integrity Commissions, versus, say, the Royal Commissions of Police Inquiry, where we had that, I think, 3-4 years ago, and they were looking into the deaths of various detainees as well, and whether or not they have powers over each other, or which commission has power, a stronger power over the other. Because essentially, there's no point having these commissions if no action is going to be taken against the cops, or actions that are going to be taken against the cops are going to be milder action rather than the full-blown action.
Yeah, I think it's important to know what kind, on your point, what kind of action, because often there could be just a removal of the police officer or shifting off of duty. I think this, in this case, since it's been found to, this is the findings of the study, clearly it requires some kind of legal action on the part of Bukit Aman, right? Okay, we'll keep you abreast on any developments from that. At the moment, the case is still ongoing. This is just the EAIC making their findings public, but the IGP has said that the case is ongoing, so he refuses to comment. In other news, a quick look at the environment that's been hit by the El Nino phenomenon, the dry, hot weather that we're experiencing. Yesterday, the government was set to announce whether to declare Bukit Merah in Perak a disaster area because of the hot weather. Timah Taso in Perlis had also requested to be declared a disaster area, but Putrajaya has decided not to do that for legal and financial implications, but say they will implement relief measures immediately. Another person has also died from the heat stroke, raising to 2 the number of people who have succumbed to the condition so far due to the hot weather. It's getting bad now. We're talking about deaths.
Yeah, I think it, or perhaps people aren't taking the kind of precautions that they really need to, including being hydrated, keeping out the sun as much as you can, because it's very difficult to change your lifestyle, isn't it? Despite the heat, people kind of tend to do the same thing because they complain more about it.
I remember last week the Star carried a headline: "Too much weather from El Nino to La Nina." So we are experiencing El Nino early on. This is La Nina that going to experience end of the year, and expect floods and flooding then. So I really think there's a case for green here. I think green businesses, green technology.
Yeah, we should be paying attention to the impact on the climate for sure. The person who recently died, the fatality of the heat stroke, is a 23-year-old woman. Excuse me, man, 23-year-old man, a trainee of a basic course for young volunteer servicemen.
Yeah, so this is like the cop really who passed away.
Yeah, exactly. So the first fatality was also in early 20s.
Yeah,
right?
Early 20s. Also,
do we know the circumstances? Were they out in the under the sun? Did they die from heat stroke or?
Yeah.
Not too sure about the conditions of the death, but it has been ruled. The cause of death has been ruled as heat stroke. Bank Negara has issued a letter of administrative compound to 1MDB for failing to comply with directions issued under the Financial Services Act 2013. And 1MDB has been given until the end of May to pay this compound.
Yeah, we had Arul Kanda over for a breakfast grill, and I asked him specifically on this. Did you do, or what did you not do with regard to the request from Bank Negara to repatriate back the funds? And he gave a very long-winded answer, and the short version of it is there's no more money to be repatriated back. That's the short answer to it. And following that, Bank Negara has taken that time to actually because there's always this: I have given you an instruction and you have failed to comply, what's next, right? The onus is on Bank Negara to act, and now Bank Negara has acted and they are facing an administrative compound.
Well, Tan Sri Zeti Akhtar Aziz, her tenure is up at the end of April, so this is what her final day in office, essentially. And lo and behold, she's going out with a bang by saying, by issuing this compound to 1MDB. However, what Bank Negara says that this, the payment of that compound that they issued will mark the conclusion of the investigation by Bank Negara on any contraventions of the rules and regulations of the central bank.
The Singapore Straits Times says that the amount was not specified. So it's not more, it's not about the amount. It's actually about the action or the implication that this administrative compound carries. And we'll carry more about this news later at our 7:30 news. But as the story develops, we will understand better what's going on.
Okay. 6:21 right now, and new research has suggested that living closer to nature is better for your health and may even extend your life. So a study that was just published in the Journal of Environmental Health Perspectives found that people who live in greener areas with more vegetation around them have a lower risk of mortality. The health benefits are likely thanks to factors such as improved mental health, social engagement and physical activity that come with living near green spaces.
Would you be less stressed out, Melissa, than if you were in the jungles, wild, the chances of, you know, a vicious animal coming by or a snake, a poisonous snake, would that calm you down?
Okay, I know the right answer is to say we all love nature, but I'm a city girl through and through. And I love the comforts of modern conveniences and that all that that has afforded us. I would be a little bit more stressed living... let me just rephrase that. I don't think that living out near greener spaces would bring me any more joy than living where I am, looking at my potted plant.
Okay, but maybe, you know, if you just sort of take the study at face value, there's a question of whether you would even recognize some of the signs of, say, tension, right, that comes from living in a built-up urban environments where you might not have wild animals, but you might have wild human beings or, you know, poisonous neighbors. I mean, who knows, right? There's a 100 things that make urban living stressful, including the pollution, which is kind of invisible. We all live with it. We breathe the air. We don't recognize it.
And but what does to our bodies.
The bodies, right? So our bodies are registering this as stress. Perhaps, you know, in urban settings, we are more likely to be able to reach out and get some food and we get, you know, really bad food. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons that, there are all kinds of stresses that you might not even register as a stress. You like the city and built-up environments because you're used to it. It's just a function of habit.
Actually, to be completely honest with you, as a child, I spent a lot of time in the kampung, and I lived with my auntie and uncle who worked for the Penang Botanical Gardens.
Right.
Grew up in a really green space.
Okay, hold on. Botanical gardens. It's not the same as the kampung.
Well.
It's a completely manufactured space.
I grew up in a kampung and later went on to live on the botanical gardens.
Melissa Idris has kampung cred. I think that's what she's saying.
Okay. But what I'm trying to say is that growing up with something doesn't necessarily shape the way you feel about something. I grew up with green open spaces. Yeah. Doesn't mean I naturally gravitate towards wanting to live outdoors. Yeah.
So a friend of mine grew up in Jalan Peel in Cheras. He has known only urban setting throughout his life. Upon graduation, he actually left KL for good. And he's now, you know, in a Malay heartland in Terengganu. He's doing some businesses there. And he says that there's no way that he's going to come back to
live back
in town.
Right?
Yeah,
it's just
there's
what you
no
prefer.
Way.
Okay. What do you prefer, Sharad?
My preference, of course, is for a kind of urban setting with lots of people. I do find the quiet, the good air quite distressing. I mean, like, you know, how much good air can any, you know, one person have? I think because I like people, I crave a certain density in terms of people. I like the diversity of people. I think when you go out into the jungle, into natural environments, you could see far fewer people, and they're very kind of spaced out. I think not spaced out as in sort of zonked out. I mean, spaced out meaning there are lower densities in terms
what
of
what about the benefits of just being around nature, around greenery, around vegetation? Does that make you feel calm?
Yeah, it definitely makes me feel calm, at least because, you know, research has shown that the two countries that live the longest would be Turkey and Japan.
People in those countries?
The people in those countries. And they have a good, a striking balance between being urbanized as well as being very close to nature. And that diet is important as well. So I think while greenery is important, what you put in your body is very crucial. Yeah. Olive oil, fresh food, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
So again, the article which we tweeted out, there's a link to it. In fact, Steve has weighed in. He says urban pollution is more than air pollution. It's also noise and pollution. Light pollution. Yeah, yeah, I think it's very
point.
True. Thanks, Steve. But the issue really, it's a question of jobs and whether certain jobs make you happy. So if you read this article, which comes from this Indian magazine called Live Mint, you get this narrative of somebody who works, you know, she's an Indian naturalist. She's always looking at, I don't know what exactly she works on. I'm just remember. She looks at large mammals, I believe. And her husband's a hepatologist and he works on...
What's a hepatologist?
Works on like frogs, I think, basically. And so they describe how excited she is by her work, how the discovery of a little, you know, a butterfly of a particular species that she's identified leads into this paroxysms of delight, you know.
Wow.
And the writer likens it to her winning the lottery. Every time she sees something of this sort, she gets all very excited. And so the question of, you know, that joy that comes from being in the environment and the work that's related to that environment, right? As opposed to many people who work in jobs where there's much more routine, there's less surprise.
Yeah.
You know, and such.
If I could quote a little bit from the article, it says here that naturalists are among the happiest people or professionals that this author has met. They laugh a lot. They have an air of calm and peace around them. And this applies to naturalists who are doing the research they love in the grasslands, mountains or forests. But it also applies to those who work in safari lodges with demanding clients and employers. It's about, it's that they get out in the bush and become energized.
So, okay. So Shobha Narayanan, who's the writer, hasn't come to BFM yet and doesn't recognize that, you know, if she'd walked in through the, you know, the offices of BFM, she'd see a lot of happy people. But aren't you happy?
Well, I don't know whether we have an air of happy calm and peace around us, though. I think that's kind of key. When you go out,
there's natural vibrations in the wilds, right? The humming, the low humming of birds, yeah, and insects,
the crickets, and I don't know about you.
Water,
guys.
The bubbling brooks. Yeah. You know,
I would, as a person, I really would love to live in you know, near these, you know, background noises, fresh air, and so on. But I can't. Imagine
yourself doing that.
Yeah, you know, just set up camp, off I go, you know, boil the water across the river. I don't know. I'm not that kind of
rugged
guy.
But also, can I point out something truly, like a really key thing here? It's a complete difference to be living in a Malaysian jungle setting and say in the woods of New Zealand, moss-covered stones and little
that's
bumbling brooks.
Isn't it?
You know, yeah. I mean, that's completely different, right? I mean,
why is that temperate?
Because of
climbs?
Like Pachat and Linta, all these things come into play.
Haven't you watched Game of Thrones? There are all kinds of creepy crawlies out in the forest, yeah, you know, and the dangers and wild animals
that's
that could bite your head up.
A realistic setting, though.
No, I mean, okay, I mean, maybe not Game of Thrones, but you know, temperate climes also produce, bugs and flies and gnats and, you know, things that
it's
suck your blood.
It's a much more pleasant.
Well, only on television.
We've been overseas. I actually have been camping in the woods of New Zealand and thought it was really lovely to just sleep on the moss. It's natural bedding. And I'm not even a green outdoorsy
person.
Can you
imagine like doing that full time?
Speaking about people who are happier than others, apparently millennials are happier than baby boomers. Well, to be more precise, are more optimistic about the future.
Is that scientific? Is that data-driven?
It is data-driven.
This is highly scientific, Sharad. We have some graphs here. showing some stuff.
Lots of squiggly lines.
Squiggly lines, blue lines, and a big circle at the end of the graph that says...
I sense the sarcasm.
That says, millennials, very optimistic about the future. It was hilarious. And it was, you know, this graph doesn't tell much other than the fact that there's some squiggly lines and showing...
You know, you think that, right, with all the news about climate change, about the possibility of the planet being engulfed with extreme weather, and that's just the beginning, that millennials would be less optimistic about the future. After all, you know, where people like myself are likely to die long before these calamitous, you know, climatic changes happen, right? So why is it that they are so optimistic about the future? Okay. Is it they just haven't read the news because their attention span is so short?
No, actually, let's refocus. So the squiggly lines that we're speaking about is about consumer confidence. And the research has been done by Deutsche Bank, and they are trying to capture consumer confidence for people under 35 versus consumer confidence for people over 55.
So that's slightly different.
Okay, but
consumer confidence, if it's just part of the basket of yardsticks to make you optimistic about the future, that'd be one thing. Because what is consumer confidence but your willingness to spend now rather than to save, right?
You think it's going to get better in the future.
Well, because you think you're going to be earning, right? Whereas if somebody is much older, might be more cautious about the world economy, might be saying, well, I got to save for retirement. I'm not going to just spend, everything I earn and live paycheck to paycheck, where millennials might be.
Fair enough. But if you did a quick search about millennials and it's their sense of optimism for the future, you will see that it's not just limited to consumer confidence. It is about everything. Generally, millennials are more optimistic than the generations before them. And I'm wondering whether this is just a measure of youth. You know, the ignorance is bliss that comes with, being young.
I think that whole prospect, I have greater prospects over others, I think that notion is there. And based on this research, the Deutsche Bank's chief international economist, Thorsten Slok, attributes optimism to two key things. One of them is that millennials have less debt than the older generation, for obvious purposes, because they haven't had time to create
that. So we have to clarify, is it millennials are more optimistic than baby boomers currently are, or baby boomers back when they were also at the same age?
That's an interesting question.
Yeah.
You should be in scientific research.
Oh, thank you very much.
Research.
I'll consider a career change.
But the second reason why he believes
become a Scottish actor.
That millennials...
Mr. Bond.
Back to the thing, the second reason why he believes that optimism is there is because the unemployment situation for young people is a little bit better than that of the older people.
Okay, so I think this is all context-driven, right? So it will really depend on the national context of which you're talking about, because in some countries, like France, for instance, where, unemployment rates are high. I mean, Western Europe, right? There's some parts of Western Europe where people are, the chances of getting a job are very low if you come out of university or out of the schooling system. And so why would you be optimistic, in that kind of context?
Yeah, but okay, if we were to go back to the measure of age and youth, right? Is it, on a more philosophical note, moving away from data-driven research, is it that you become more pessimistic, less optimistic as you get older? Is that something?
Well, okay,
that
so you're looking at me just because I'm over 50.
Because I just like looking at you. So yeah.
Okay, so this is it. Let me initiate you into the mysteries of being old. I think one of the things, of course, is that you've seen so much, right? You might be less inclined to believe that people can change, or even circumstances can change in any kind of radical and meaningful way. And so when you're young, you might be more given to throwing your energies behind a project for social change, for instance. But by the time you hit 15, you think, well, actually, it's a much more complicated affair, these things called people and society. And therefore, maybe you become not less optimistic, but you certainly mellow out. I think there's a mellowing out in some people who grow older. There's a... their sense of urgency about changing their immediate environment might be reduced. They might be much more philosophical.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all possible. I mean, but there are all kinds of old people, grumpy old people and cheery old people.
And that's why Obama, very recently, I think last week, he has made a public statement saying that do not stop dreaming, do not stop hoping, because he is saying that in the context of the current political landscape in the US, because a lot of cynicism is in the air, a lot of hate mongering by at least by Trump versus others is there, and he doesn't want the young folks to just lose his optimism, and there is a call for that. But there is also another news coming in from Bloomberg that says a coming collapse in investment returns means that people of the age of 30 may have to work 7 years longer or save almost twice as much to end up with the same nest egg as those roughly a generation ago. So
okay,
you
so
may have to work longer.
Yeah, so clearly analysts' optimism of the future doesn't really jive with the millennials' optimism of the future. Yesterday, I was hosting Ringgit and Cents, and it was the final Thursday of the month, so it was Ringgit Ringgit. It was a call-in show. And most of the questions seem to be from younger people.
Yeah.
Young people under 30 or 30 asking about how they can save more, how they can save enough to buy a house, what they can do, what kind of should they be looking at investments? And that really kind of, I was a bit taken aback by that, because for me, that really showed young people are really worried about their personal finances here in Malaysia. So
and
I don't
not
know.
Just any personal finances, but savings.
Savings, yeah.
We always
buying
talk
a
about
house,
debt.
For instance,
yeah, we always talk about debt, or credit card debt, and then scholarship and school debt and so on. But this is a critical question. It's about savings. I was listening in from the outside. It was really starking, wasn't
it?
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I wonder whether this survey, clearly it's US-centric. You know, American millennials are far more optimistic about their future, about consumer confidence, about the economy, than perhaps Malaysian millennials, for instance.
Yeah. Do you find that? I mean, I try not to hang out with too many young people.
I people, just not the young ones.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some toxicity in that. No, I'm just kidding. No, but what's your measure of things when you look at people in your own circle, people in their early 30s and their late 20s? Do you find there's a tremendous amount of optimism about the future? And is that optimism related solely to possibilities and circumstances in this country? Or do they, as Malaysians, so many Malaysians do, seek their fortunes overseas and think, well, there's a big, bright world out there. I'm going to go and explore that.
Well, not everyone can do that. And just talking to the people in my circle, I wouldn't say there's a lack of optimism or to use pessimism is a bit strong. It's more heightened worry. They're worried. They're constantly worried about paying bills, about buying a house, about making ends meet at the end of the month. And I wonder whether, I thought I was alone in this, but I guess everyone shares the same kind of feeling.
Well, Rayan Grumpyland is the handle. So I don't know what her real name is, if the profile picture is a representation of the person behind it. Tweeted and said, but the lack of attention span might be a contribution to optimism. I think it's just a reference to the remark we made, or perhaps I made. And she says, not. So that's her response. No, it's not about a lack of attention to, the news.
But I'm reading her tweet as not data-driven, because she had the hashtag data-driven.
Yeah, not data-driven. Come on, Sherrod. It's not a not data driven, not millennials.
So, Rain Grumpyland, why don't you
explain further
your tweet?
What you did? Because we are clearly going to be talking about this for the rest of the morning. What did she really mean?
6:49, just turning 6:50 right now. News is coming up at the top of the hour, 7 o'clock on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.